The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. Our guest Rahul Mehta's debut poetry collection, Feeding the Ghosts, explores the solace to be found in the everyday beauty, sometimes overshadowed by larger calamity, as well as the author's identities, relationships, and culture. Mehta's other works include the short story collection Quarantine and the novel No Other World, which George Saunders described as a compelling, magical, big-hearted, lyrical book. They have contributed work to a number of publications, including the Kenyon Review, the Massachusetts Review, and the New York Times Magazine, and they've earned a Lambda Literary Award and an Asian American Literary Award. Please welcome Rahul Mehta.
Setting my timer. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I feel so touched to see so many faces of folks I know and care about and dear ones. I have been to so many readings at this library, and I've always admired this, you know, this stunning, stunning thing. And now I get to stand at it, and I get to touch it, and I get to lean on it. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing. I want to thank Andy Cahan for inviting me to read, and I'm sorry that Hala Alian had to cancel, and so we're all wishing her well. So I'm going to read a number of poems from my book, Feeding the Ghosts. I'll read for about 20 minutes, so you know. And maybe I will start with the title poem. So the title poem, maybe it's not a good poem to start with, actually, because it's a little bit of a tricky poem to read because it relies on a bit of a visual joke. So it hinges on this word play with the word ancestor and ant-cester, as in the insect, the ant. So this poem, so I'll try to, I guess since you can't see it on the page, I'll try to kind of emphasize that as I'm reading it. Okay. Every poem I write is called Feeding the Ghosts, including this one. In my head, I'm making a terrible pun about the insects swarming our dining room table. Ant-cesters. Also on the table, a Dia de los Muertos candle molded in pale yellow beeswax, wilting white roses, a small cream-colored ceramic silo with a gold leaf slit thrown and fired by a friend that she calls a spirit house, a tarot card stamped with a skull, and a collection of cup-shaped forest-gathered treasures. Broken nutshells, curled leaves, warped, wet bark. We know these last items are likely the source of the ants, but Robert half jokes, half not, that they must live in the spirit house, though neither of us has seen them go in or out. It is true, I have of late been calling on the ancestors, designating empty chairs for them, offering them tangerines in bone china teacups splurge purchased in Delhi a decade ago, delicate edges etched with red and gold roses. I've made offerings also to the ancestors, dinner crumbs I do not brush from the marigold tablecloth, scraps of a late-night sandwich left on a plate until morning. But the ancestors overwhelm me, And days later, I return the forest-gathered items to their rightful place and carry the ancestors onto the fire escape with file folders. I'd like to think I do not harm them, not a single one, but I know it's not true. The ancestors are fragile, and I am clumsy, as all humans are, and easily distracted. And my thumbs, after all, are anvils, are cannonballs, are cyclones spun by a warming planet, are avalanches, are hammers, more accustomed to pounding out smartphone missives than ushering into the next world, or gently across this one, tiny visiting souls. So, a few weeks ago, we lost our beloved dog, Kimona, who had been in our life for more than 10 years. I'm going to try to say this without crying. Kimona is woven throughout this collection. She appears in many poems. You'll hear some of them tonight. But this poem in particular I want to read now in her honor. It's called Morning Poem. Many of the poems in this collection are called Morning Poem. Morning Prayer. It's called Morning Prayer. Many of the poems in this collection are called Morning Prayer. That might be because I'm terrible at titles, and maybe it seems easier just to call everything Morning Prayer. But I do think it's also because so many of these poems were written in the morning and were, of sorts, a prayer. So let me see if I can find this. Morning Prayer. August, and Kimona is watching me from the corner of the bedroom, waiting for me to stir. Robert has been up for an hour or more, rattling around in the kitchen, doing whatever it is morning people do. Kimona wants someone to open the door so she can join him, begin her day. But she is a good dog, or rather, she is a bad dog who is trying to be good. And so she doesn't want to wake me. But then it happens. I sigh and turn, and there she is, standing suddenly at the side of the bed, her tail like a pinwheel spinning faster and faster. The heavy curtains and rumbling window unit have kept our bedroom dark and cool, so I'm not quite ready for the assault of heat and light when I swing open the door. And, as with so many days of late, I'm not sure I can face this one. After letting her out, I climb back into the bed and hermetically reseal the room. Yesterday evening, Robert and I played tennis. Swatting the ball, I remembered childhood. I wrote in my journal, I had a happy childhood, and then thought better of it and added, aside from the racism, and then aside from the racism and homophobia, and then aside from the racism and homophobia and xenophobia. But it is true. I had a happy childhood. I was a happy child. Everyone said so. In the dark bedroom, I try to recall last night's dream, scanning it for messages. I start constructing in my head a gratitude list. I think about the cold cantaloupe already cut up in the fridge and how good it will taste. I think about the book I've been reading, which I like but do not love. I try not to think about the unanswered emails in my inbox. I try not to think about the news or the weeks and months of uncertainty gathering like rainwater in an ever-deepening pool, the impossible task of trying to swim through it. 2 hours pass, maybe three. I haven't moved. The bedroom door squeaks open. Robert is bringing me coffee, and behind him, Kimona, who has already done everything, has had her breakfast and her walk, has chased a hare and dug a hole and grazed on grass and played with Satchel and splashed in the kiddie pool Josh sets out in summer. She trots in, happy and proud, carrying in her mouth neither a ball nor her favorite squeaky cupcake, but the sun, the earth, the air, the whole bright world, filthy and gleaming and wild and redolent. She lays it at the foot of my bed, lies down next to it. She's a good dog, or rather, she's a bad dog trying to be good. I am trying too. I am trying in every way I know how. She will wait. Thank you. I'm going to read a poem called Birthright. This poem is in three parts, and it begins with it's called My Birthright. It's in three parts. Each part is titled, and it begins with an epigraph by the great Tracy K. Smith, who, if you haven't read, you should. This comes from her memoir, From Ordinary Light. My Birthright. Pain was a part of my birthright, part of what was meant by a word like home. From Ordinary Light by Tracy K. Smith. Fear is my birthright. My father trod carefully, perhaps never fully believing this country was his. He didn't speak up. He didn't say no. He introduced himself by his initials only, made it easy, didn't make them form their mouths around foreign sounds, around hard, dark syllables, didn't ask that people say his name. I never made them say my name either. Let them call me Chocolate Boy and Ragu, and later, worse. I went quietly to my school locker, stored there my books, my pencils, and in my magnetic mirror, my true reflection, and locked it all away. Shame is my birthright. Because I imagined the towel wrapped around my 8-year-old body was a dress, because of the dolls, the Hello Kitty jewelry box, the trapper keeper with a big-eyed cotton ball kitten in a field of daisies. I miss that trapper keeper. Because when we played pretend, I said I was pretending to be James Bond, but secretly I was pretending to be a Bond girl. Because many years later, when I told my mom about my then-boyfriend, now-partner, she said she hoped he wasn't one of those swishy gays. And I thought, but I am one of those swishy gays. Then vowed to try my hardest not to be. Because Vivek Shraya came to me in a dream recently, looking all kinds of Mahalakshmi glam, and gave me a bindi and a set of sparkly bangles and whispered, don't forget who you are. But maybe I already have. Joy is my birthright. My tarot cards tell me to be naked, make it a ritual, do it in public. I want to tell about fire. Nakedness, literal and metaphoric, terrifies me. I want to tell about joy. One, at the Korean baths last December, I was naked. Two, canoeing in the Adirondacks 5 years ago, I was half naked. Does that count? 3. In Maine, last summer, in the low tide cove, crouching in the gray clay that almost swallowed me whole, I was naked. I was thinking about Shiva. I want to tell about fire. I was thinking about Kali last summer when Mel and Christine visited us in Philly on the hottest weekend in years, and we walked 4 miles midday and collapsed on a rock on a cliff above the creek that breaks my heart. Crick, my Appalachian self says, the crick that bricks my heart. I want to tell about joy. I want to break my heart. I want to tell about fire. I want to brick my heart. I want to tell about joy. Thank you. I think I'll read a poem called Let Her. Let her do what she needs to do, says the tall woman outside the cafe, except that the she in question is my large, badly behaved dog, and what she needs to do, evidently, is snarl and growl and bark at the woman, and I don't know if I should pull her away or distract her with a mango-flavored dog treat or to, as the woman has instructed, let her. The woman is wearing a tight mid-thigh leather-looking skirt this weekday afternoon, a boxy blouse, and lipstick the color of crushed cranberries, which is smeared on the rim of her white paper cup. And I don't know if I should mention here that the woman is trans, or rather, I perceive her to be trans, because how would I know for sure? If it is relevant to the poem, relevant to anything, and maybe to even mention it is to other her. Except that I noticed it right away, and I can't help thinking that when she said, let her do what she needs to do, she was, on some level, talking about herself. Eventually, my dog loses interest in the woman, or I pull her away, or I throw a treat a little distance down the sidewalk. I don't remember how that part unfolds, but I do remember the woman crossing the street, climbing into her vehicle, a Jeep, not a soccer mom SUV. I hate the term soccer mom for all of its condescension, its coded misogyny. I hate that soccer mom is where my mind has gone. But a Jeep, the kind I longed for as a teenager in West Virginia, brown, queer, closeted. Did I long for the Jeeps or for the boys who drove them? A Jeep with big wheels and thick tread and manual gears, a Jeep that could cross creeks, climb mountains, that could tear down a dirt road, no matter mud or obstacle or incline or inclement weather, and drive to the very edge of the wide river that defines our town and where gathered teens. So easy in their bodies and sense of belonging and what belonged to them. Swimming, boating, drinking, a Jeep that could take me all those places I wasn't allowed and never dared to go. And now I know what I've always known, even if I don't yet understand, that the woman with the lipstick the color of crushed cranberries, when she said what she said, was also talking about me. Maybe I'll read another morning prayer poem. Morning prayer. Seeing a squirrel this morning in the September sun, shadows and light lacing the lawn, laboring over a huge apple, Jupiter bright, scarcely carryable up the steep tree. My heart swells for the ways in which we are all trying our best to survive, to seize, when we can, some sunshine. What scavenged incandescence have I squirreled away for tonight? In the dark halls of the house that is big me, little me keeps stumbling, stubbing their toe, crying out. Do they remember they have filled their cupboards with the patter of rain on new leaves, with river rocks, mica-flecked, shimmering like ankle bells in a Bharatanatyam dance? I think I'm maybe going to read two more poems. I'm going to do something in between the poems. So let me read one, and then I'm going to do my thing, and then I'll read the final poem. Thank you all again so much for being here. What a pleasure this is for me. This poem is called We Will Sing. We wanted to bring home all that followed us, the dog that followed us, the child that followed us, the cat that followed us, the snake that followed us, the river that followed us, the rock that followed us, the cloud that followed us, the song that followed us, the air of loss and possibility that followed us. We wanted to gather them all at the American consulate, get them all visas and international flights, to be able to have our magnetic charm and desirability affirmed at will and endlessly in our small apartment stateside. The dog would have worms, we knew. The child would require shots and a nanny and shelves of tissues to wipe its nose. The river would demand a bigger backyard, and the cloud would bring monsoons that would drown the summer sun. But the song we will sing in every room, out every window, in every shower, we will make up words, write new lyrics, a new bridge. The neighbors will hear the song. Our coworkers will hear the song, our friends will hear the song, our family will hear the song, our bigoted aunt who we have to endure every New Year's Eve will hear the song. And when the snake strikes, or the cat scratches, or the rock falls, or the air presses down like hot daggers, we will sing, we will sing, we will sing. So I want to pause for a moment to do something. I've never really done this before in public or with people. It's sort of a little bit of a risk for me. So you wouldn't necessarily, I think, know it by just reading the collection, but my tarot practice was actually a big influence in the crafting of this collection. And really more, I guess, in the crafting of the collection, but also just in providing a lens for self-inquiry that led to many of the poems. So, you know, my tarot practice, I guess a lot of people use tarot in many different ways. You know, some people use tarot as to do sort of predictive work or divination. I think I use tarot primarily as a source of self-reflection. Right, as another lens through which to examine my life. So many of these poems arose from a morning practice. I mean, sort of hence the titles Morning Prayer, a morning practice of journaling, drawing a tarot card, using the tarot card as a prompt for more journaling. Right? So what I want to do now as sort of an offering to you all is I'd like to draw a tarot card for us, sort of collectively, and I'm going to give you a prompt, you know, that you might think about or work with that's connected to the tarot card, right? So if you need a journaling prompt for later tonight or tomorrow morning, maybe this can be one for you. All right, what is this? Oh, dear, really? Okay, no, this is a good one. No, this is a good one. This is a good one. This is actually a great one. This is a great one. So I drew the Four of Swords, and I think the way that I've always worked with this card, and I think it's different for different people. Different people have different relationships with the cards. This card, for me, has always been a card that tells me, slow the fuck down, lie down, take rest, right? And so I think what I would encourage you to do as a writing prompt connected to this is maybe think about, where in your life are you working too hard? Where are you moving too fast? Are there places where you can slow down? Are there places that you can carve out rest, even if it makes other people mad? Even if it pisses your colleagues off, right? Even if it pisses your family members off, right? Are there ways that you can just take some moments to slow down? You know, what I have found with working with slowness, I feel like I've been very slow these past years since the pandemic. I feel like I've been very slow these past weeks in working through grief from the death of my dog. One of the things I think I've learned about slowness is the way that it makes everything else expand, right? And so I guess that's my invitation to you, my offering, if you wish, is to think about rest, think about slowness. And I know that also, there's a lot of privilege attached to that too. Not everyone feels like not everyone has space in their lives for rest or slowness, or it feels that way, I guess. But maybe there's a way to just slow down just a little bit for 10 minutes. So that's the Four of Swords. I'm going to end with a poem that I'd like to read from my mother. My mother is going through a difficult thing right now. And so this poem is for her. It's called The Song. And I would also like to dedicate this to all the term that Maggie Nelson uses in her book, The Argonauts, is the many-gendered mothers of your lives. Right, the many-gendered mothers of your lives. It's called The Song, and it uses it starts with an epigraph that's quoted from Amy Hempel's short story collection, Sing to It. And Amy Hempel attributes the quote to an Arabian proverb. Okay. So this is called The Song. When danger approaches, sing to it. Arabian proverb quoted in Amy Hempel's Sing to It. When danger approaches, sing to it. My mother has a terrible voice, but she was the only one who knew all the words, so she sang the loudest. By terrible, I mean the sound of uncooked rice being poured into a stainless steel dabba. By terrible, I mean the color of dry leaves on the forest floor in winter at dusk. Thursdays, we'd gather in front of the small altar on the low table in my parents' bedroom in West Virginia, ring a bell, a replica of the Liberty Bell, though none of us had been to Philadelphia, and sing songs of devotion. Twameva Mata, Om Jaya Jagadishahare, Shri Rama Rama Ramete. My brother and I mumbled. My father whispered. My mother, though not particularly religious, roared. Then there was the Lowry electric organ bought from the mall with preset rhythms for samba and rumba and waltz and sound effects for flute, strings, horn, and a button for vibrato. Money was so tight back then, I don't know that my father would have agreed to the purchase had my mother not said the organ was for my brother and me, so we could learn music, so we could be well-rounded candidates when it came time to apply for college. We barely touched it. Evenings after long, difficult days, my mother would go into the organ room, a bird on her shoulder, and play and squawk. 76 trombones led the big parade. I could have danced all night. It's cherry pink and apple blossom white. Now it is more than 30 years later. I have had a long, difficult day of my own. The world has. It is April, and I'm walking my dog in my neighborhood, Philadelphia. I finally made it here. And down the street, the sakura are pink puffs of cotton candy. And in our yard, the apple tree is erupting. I hear my mother's voice singing to me. It is the sweet smell of blossoms on the breeze. Thank you all so much. Oh, yes. So, you know, I'm happy to chat, take questions, if anyone has any. Or you could just stand up and tell me what your favorite flower is. And I'm genuinely curious. I'd like to know.
My favorite flower is an orchid.
Ooh, which ones?
Oh, gosh, I'm not really good at flowers, but anything blue, purple family.
And why?
The color and the shape, and it's kind of sexy, right? Like, I just think it's a sexy
they
shape.
Are, yes.
And they grow sexy in hot climates and, yeah, everything
yes,
like that.
Yes. Yes, sing praise to the orchid. Yeah. Oh, do you have a flower back there? Okay. Oh, you have a question. Okay, all right. I think that's okay, too. Oh, thank you. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. These are garden collected. Oh, so beautiful. Oh, sorry. Okay, sorry. Go ahead.
No worries. I'm curious, can you talk a little bit about how do you approach writing? And, you know, thank you for sharing your memories with us. Just how do you go from memories to writing a poem?
Yeah, I don't know. The other day in one of my, so I teach creative writing at the University of the Arts, and the other day in my creative writing class, we were watching an interview with the writer Kaiming Chang, and she said something about, it's just sort of sticking in my head, and maybe because I just heard it the other day, she was talking about letting language lead. And I love that idea. You know, I mean, one of my mentors in grad school, the great George Saunders, he had told me once, or he told us once in class, you know, you don't have to think so hard about what you want to write about. You know, I mean, if you're sort of in touch with yourself and in touch with your heart, that's always going to come out. You know, you don't have to sit down and say, oh, I want to write a story about X. If X is a deep part of who you are, and if you're in touch with that, it's always going to come out anyway. So you don't have to sit down thinking, oh, I'm going to write about, you know, X. And in fact, I think sometimes when one does that, then you get a piece that is sort of overdetermined or lacks a certain kind of playfulness or lacks a certain kind of surprise. And it's also maybe not very interesting for the writer. You know, I think that these days I am so much less interested in whether I'm writing a good poem or a good story or whatever than I am in what is happening to me while I'm writing this. Right? You know, so I think I usually, I think with a lot of things, And I think maybe this is easier with poetry too, because you're only committing to something for a page or two, right? I mean, a novel is a little bit different because novels take years and you have to really kind of spend time in that space. But yeah, I mean, I think I just often start with an image or a bit of language or something that is compelling me. And I never, ever, ever know where poems are going, ever. There's not a single poem in this collection that I would have been able to tell you it was going there. So for instance, that poem that I read, Let Her, I mean, that really did just start with my dog growling at this woman, right? And I never knew it was going to come around to a poem that was about sort of my own experiences with gender and, you know, and reconciling and working through my own shame around my own femininity, right? I never knew that's what that poem was going to be about. It was really just started with, oh, my dog growled at this woman. Okay, yeah. The poem that I ended with, the song, I didn't even know that was going to be a poem about my mother. Like, I didn't know that that's where that was going. I mean, it really was that. I wrote that in class one day. We used the prompt, When danger comes, sing to it. And we just did it in class, and I wrote that in class. Which, by the way, that is a great journaling prompt. When danger comes, sing to it. Just go from there. I think beautiful things will come. Thank you for that question. Karthi. Oh, no, don't ask a hard one.
I'm not going to ask any math questions, I promise. You have all of these poems in the book. When do you know you're done? I've always, even in the math papers that I write, I never know when I'm done.
I think there is no done. I think it's like, when is it time to let go? Right? There is no done, I think, ever. When I published my first short story collection, the earliest story in that collection was written 10 years. Those poems spanned 10 years. Sorry, those stories spanned 10 years, right? So it's like it was 2010 when I'm getting ready to publish it. The first story in that collection was written in 2000, right? And I had to sort of ask myself, I'm not the same person anymore. I'm not the same writer. Am I going to sort of go back and rewrite it the way I would now? And I don't know. I mean, I think it's like, two nights ago was the full moon. I always think of the full moons as being about letting go. And I think letting go of things is really crucial in creating space for new things to grow, right? And so it's sort of like, when am I ready to let go of this, right? Could it be a better poem? Sure. Of course it could be a better poem. But when is it just time to let go and make space for something else, right? Yeah. But that's also hard. It's hard to do. It's hard to, you know, it's hard to sort of have that clarity. But I like to, I mean, that's why a full moon is often, it's like it's sort of like this monthly invitation to kind of catalog for yourself what's ready to be let go of, right? And maybe if it shows up 3 or 4 months in a row, you can be like, okay, now maybe I can try. Yeah. Thank you.
I was wondering if you could speak to how you started, or when maybe you started incorporating tarot into your practice.
I think I started it, it might have been like 2017 or 2018. I think it was 2017, maybe 2016. There's this woman named Suzanne, I think her name is Suzanne Conway or Susanna Conway. She does this she does a lot of things, but I think I sort of stumbled across this workbook that she does at the end of each calendar year called Unraveling Your Year. And it's just like a workbook to kind of think through, to unravel your year and kind of think to the year ahead. And there are many activities in her workbook, but one of them was a tarot prompt. And I'd never worked with tarot before. I'd never done tarot before, but I wanted to sort of do the workbook. And so I downloaded a tarot app, one of the ones that she recommended. Maybe she's getting paid for that. I don't know. Okay, anyway, but it almost right away kind of made sense to me. You know, I felt very sort of drawn in by it and very connected to it. There's a writer, Leah Lakshmi. What is her name? Leah Lakshmi. let me see if I can find it very quickly. But anyway, well, I'll tell you. So she talks about how magic, practices around magic, divination, have always been a birthright for queer folk, brown folk, marginalized folk. And, you know, and I think I felt like sort of drawn to sort of wanting to get in touch with more of that sense of magic also and open my senses to that. And so I've used tarot in a lot of different ways. I mean, I use it mostly as a tool for self-reflection, but I sometimes do, like I'll do, if I'm working on a, like actually when I was working on my novel, I would sometimes do, is that right? Well, with characters, I would do tarot readings for the characters, right? Which is sort of interesting. Yeah, but I've really, I mean, I sort of love it as a creative practice. I wanted to give you Leah Lakshmi Pipsa Samarsinha. Sorry, I'm mispronouncing her name. She also wrote an amazing, amazing book called The Future is Disabled. Amazing, amazing book. The Future is Disabled, about living in, you know, a queer, brown, disabled body. And yeah.
So how do you imagine people reading the book or reading the poems in any particular setting or any particular way?
Yeah, so this is, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking about the sequence of these poems, thinking about how poems resonate with one another, the conversations that, you know, the conversation that the poem on page 71 is having with the poem on page 72. And yet I personally never read poetry collections beginning to end. I never read short story collections beginning to end. I sometimes don't even read novels beginning to end. I mean, I tend to just like, so yeah, so it's funny because I spent so much time kind of thinking about that, and yet that's not how I read, and I figure maybe that's not how a lot of people read. You know what I hope that people will do with this book, or really any book of poetry, not just mine, any book of poetry, in your morning, in the 10 minutes that you've set aside to slow down, just read a poem. Right? Pull the book off the shelf, read a poem, put it back, you know? Do the next thing the next day, right? You know, I don't care if it takes, I think there might be like 50 poems in here. Yeah, so I don't care if it takes you a year to read them or 2 years. I think we should probably end there. I think it's sort of time. But thank you all so much for being here. It's meant so much to me. And yeah, and I hope that tomorrow morning you will take a moment to think about how you can incorporate rest and slowness in your life. So that's my invitation to you. All right, thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.